At Highland, we're all about celebrating little wins and little ways to innovate digital processes. There's no customer pain point too small for us to help with. Maybe that's why more than half of the Fortune 100 looks to Highland to connect their content and data, improve processes, and turn little efficiencies into big wins for their customers and clients. Highland, intelligent content solutions for innovators everywhere at highland.com.
The Future Proof Podcast from Newstalk.
Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland. Hashtag believe in science.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof the Podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. I'm Jonathan McRae. Now, as if going through the trauma of something like the Holocaust or a famine isn't enough, it now turns out that there may be mechanisms for you to pass on that trauma in some form to your children. Now, we've talked about epigenetics on the program before, but we'll be speaking to Brian Dias, who says there's actually other possible mechanisms through which this might happen. Fascinating science and something I hadn't fully considered. That'll be in a few minutes' time. If you'd like to email us, you can do so, science@newstalk.com. You can find us on Twitter. We're at Newstalk Science. We get to all of your comments at the end of the podcast. But before we hear from Brian, it's time to look back at the week's science news. And joining us via Skype, as they do, is Dr. Shane Bergen from UCD and double Dr. Lara Dungan. You're both very welcome. Our first story.
Bill Orton was a cautious man of the road. He walked looking over his shoulder and remained faithful to his code.
Has to do with more excitement at CERN, Shane. It's been a while since the Higgs boson was discovered, a fundamental force that was hypothesized and then proven in an experiment in CERN, the large facility that spans a couple of countries in Europe, but is mostly in Switzerland. New evidence that there may be another finding.
Yeah, absolutely. So the headlines in the paper have said new force of nature, but I looked at the CERN website and there's this far more muted. It says experts reveal cautious excitement over unstable particles that fail to decay as standard model suggests.
Cautious excitement. What does that look like? Can you imagine picture the face of the scientists with cautious excitement? I'm trying to imagine like how I put my face muscles in that expression.
Well, they've seen an unusual signal in the data. So that's at the start of their cautious excitement. And as you said, CERN is there looking at basically the standard model, which describes the particles and forces that govern the subatomic world, how elementary particles called quarks build up to make matter as we know it. It also describes three of the four fundamental forces, but not gravity. So it's an incomplete model. So they're always looking at where it'll fail as a way to kind of point us toward new physics. And it's been running this way for 10 years now, CERN, and they have seen an unusual pattern in their data. And perhaps that means a new type of physics. What particularly they've looked at is the unstable decay of a particular particle called the B meson.
Okay, before you do that, tell us what decay means.
So these particles kind of start as one thing and then they kind of move on to another. So they evolve into a different type of particle. So they decay in similar ways. It's not similar physics, but decay in the same sense as like radioactive decay, you know, going from one thing to another.
Yeah.
So the standard model predicts that B mesons should decay at an even rate into things that have electrons and into things that have heavier cousins of electrons called muons. So they say that over time, you should have the same rate of production of one as the other. And when they've looked at the data over 10 years, they've seen that there is an asymmetry there. In other words, one is preferred over the other, and that's not predicted by the model. They've seen that there is a preference for things that have electrons as opposed to muons. And so they're saying, oh, God, what does that mean? Well, first thing they do is they'd look at the significance of their findings. So sigma is always the thing that these particle physicists talk about. And they have a sigma of 3.1, which means it's a 1 in 1,000 chance that it's random. And they're normally looking for a sigma of 5, which would be a 1 in 1,000,000 chance that they're wrong. And So they're reasonably confident that there's something here, but they can't say with any certainty yet. So they have to delve deeper into this and find out whether it's real or not.
That would explain that cautious excitement.
Exactly. If it turns out, if it's true, it could be explained by a new hypothetical particle called leptoquarks. And that might bring, that's where the new force comes in. So these leptoquarks might be associated with new forces to bear on particles. Right. I find this stuff so complicated.
That's why I give it to you, Shane.
Yeah, it's it's very cool that they're looking at the fundamental nature of matter and forces of matter. But my God, this stuff is hard going.
Yeah. Well, I mean, are you giving us a good broad brush overview? Something exciting has happened. Scientists are cautiously excited. That's kind of all we need to know. Our second story, Lara, has to do with concussion diagnosis.
Yes, this is new research that's coming out of the University of Birmingham, and they're calling it a game changer in terms of fast diagnosis or pitch side diagnosis of concussions. So I suppose the game changer thing is being bounced around an awful lot recently, and I suppose for a long time, but concussions are very serious. Nearly 4 million people in the US alone get concussions annually. An awful lot of them come from sports, and there's huge long-term consequences. It's become very apparent in recent decades how serious, you know, chronic neurotrauma can be, for anything from headaches all the way up to serious cognitive impairment in the years to come. And one great way to potentially reduce that is to know in a scientific manner that somebody has got a concussion. At the moment, a head injury assessment is done on a series of symptoms that the player or that the person has to be aware of and admit to themselves. So it's a significantly flawed system. It's what we have, but it's not perfect. And the University of Birmingham have found that within minutes after significant neurotrauma that will cause concussion, our brain produces things called microRNAs. They're like nucleic acid, like the same way DNA is, except they're not used to make proteins. They're little messengers, and they're sent all around the body.
Would you say that they are kind of like RNAs, but smaller?
I would say that. If you put a gun to my head, I'd be forced into saying it, Johnny. It's believed that they go via neurons from the brain down into the salivary glands. And they are then expressed in saliva, as I said, within minutes. Now, at the moment, they've done a huge amount of research, all unfortunately in male athletes. And it's reasonably well known that gender does come into it when it comes to concussion and damage. But they looked at over 1,000 athletes who A, got neurotrauma, B, got no trauma, or C, got trauma to another part of their body, collected their saliva, brought it back to the lab and looked at the expression of these RNAs. And it's about 94% accurate in terms of being able to identify the people who do have concussion.
Wow.
So it's brilliant. It's really good accuracy. And if it bears out, if they can do it in female athletes, and if they can find a way to make this a faster test that doesn't have to go back to the lab, it would be fantastic, hopefully in association with a head injury assessment, but to get a more scientific method of saying, look, you cannot go back onto the pitch. I think this would be brilliant if it all works out.
And some, football teams are already spitting at the ref. So, I mean, half the work is already done.
Exactly. Yes.
Shane, our third story has to do with wine.
Yes.
Wine in space.
Absolutely. This is really what science should be doing, you know, like in terms of concussion or vaccines. That's all secondary to this important work that's happened since the year 2000, where bottles of wine, 12 in total, were sent to the ISS.
No, not just bottles of wine, Shane. This is Chateau Petrus. Are you joking? Is this a joke?
Yeah. Lara's face says it all, as if you have ever even seen a bottle of Chateau Petrus. This from the man that I saw
Johnny.
On Twitter this week drinking a rhubarb-based cocktail. So they brought this wine into space in order to study the aging of fine wines. And I love that they basically, the people that did this, it struck me that they were kind of looking for excuses to send it into space. So they were wondering how gravity would affect the convection of oxygen through an aging wine, and would it have effect on its taste ultimately. So they gave the analogy of when you're tasting wine, or if you're that sort of person and you do that.
Wait, whoa, what do you mean that sort of person? Like most
have
of
you
the
done that
most
in a restaurant.
Most people have tasted wine.
No, I don't mean just tasting wine. I mean doing that sucking thing with the wine. It's called opening it up. So they say that putting oxygen into it does that. And when you're aging wine slowly, there are convections in the wine with the oxygen that cause this to happen. And they're wondering how gravity would affect that if it's in space. The 12 bottles have returned. They've opened one. They can confirm that it looks different, which is great. And
different how?
Well,
has it lost its legs? What sort of?
Well, perhaps more importantly, it tastes different. So they said that the wine on Earth that stayed on Earth was more tannic and it had a younger flavor. I love wine, but I think all the language about wine is kind of crap. It's not very science.
Clearly.
I think, you know, at first I was like, why did they send 12 bottles? Like, surely a small sample was enough.
Yeah.
And this is where it gets to the interesting thing. They cost $5,000 each. So if you want to buy one, they're $5,000. And that's why it was sent into space.
I think the cost of sending wine to space is probably about the same. So I'm not sure they got the return on investment on that one. But it certainly did Chateau Petrus no harm. I love the way I have, for some strange reason, positioned myself as a wine snob.
And I love my wine and I've had my wine tasting parties and... Yes.
I know nothing about wine. I do think there's a bit of pageantry and I like a bit of ceremony, whether you're having tea or whatever. Like if it's done by people who know what they're doing, I do enjoy a bit of that. And I certainly know, you know, the wine you get in France tastes much nicer when you're, you know, sitting on the Riviera, you know, looking out at the sea or, you know, in the Alps or wherever you're drinking your flipping wine. Don't be looking at me like that. I'm just saying. God, I've really turned myself into some bourgeoisie in the space of a 50-minute news item, haven't I? But yeah, no, I think there's good studies to suggest that even wine experts aren't able to tell. Once it gets above €10, they can't really tell the difference. But look, I love a bit of show, as you know, Shane.
Absolutely.
Our final story, Lara's face has just been creased during that whole item. Our final story sounds like it should be funny, Lara, but it's actually not. It's about shrinking penises and climate change.
This is sad. So one of the reasons I want to talk about this today, it's actually a new book, so it's not necessarily one piece of new evidence. But I think it's really important to talk about this. It's a book called Countdown, and it's by Dr. Shanna Swan. She works out of Mount Sinai in New York, and she's an epidemiologist and environmental scientist. And she's done a huge amount of research in lots of different papers over the years, and it's all culminated in her producing this piece of work. And it is frankly petrifying, and I think we need to talk about it. So the headline is Penises Are Shrinking, which is a great headline, and it makes people read it. But underneath it all, it's a really horrible reality. So she talks an awful lot about fertility, and she did research that was published in 2017, which showed that the sperm count of individuals from 1973 to 2011 has dropped by nearly 60%. And what she looked at was, if you were to play that forward, she has estimated, now she's not saying this is going to happen, but she's estimated if it were to continue at that scale, by 2045, sperm counts would be zero. Okay, so she's not saying this is going to happen, but this is petrifying. And it's coming from, she believes, things called phthalates, which are chemicals that are found within plastics. And they mess with our endocrine system and they act almost like estrogen. So it causes men to respond as if they had increased estrogen in their system. And the other thing, which again is the headline, is that she's found originally in rats, but now in humans, that penis size is shrinking. Babies are being born with what we call a shorter anogenital distance, which is the distance from the anus to the genitals. And that is indicative of a smaller penis size. It's also smaller testes and also malformed genitals. She says that an average 20-something woman today is less fertile than her grandmother was at 35. Things like these phthalates, which are just omnipresent in plastics, also cause problems like erectile dysfunction. And it's just petrifying. I mean, this is... I would think of this as just a massive crisis. I don't think anyone today knows couples who aren't struggling with fertility issues. Mm. And it wasn't the same. And I know people say, oh, it was always around. It simply wasn't as prevalent if you go back 50 and certainly 100 years. And a lot of it is because of these plastics that are everywhere within our system. And it's endangering everything. I mean, they're in fetuses in the womb. Babies are being born and their urine is producing these or showing these phthalates. And it's petrifying. And I think even though it's a horrible story to end on, we really need to talk about it. And, you know, things need to be put in place, legislation to reduce the amount of these plastics that are in our systems.
Yes, as I say, sounds like a sort of a titter-titter and finally piece, but just another one of those things we got to think about, Lara. Thanks for that.
Sorry.
Right, that's it for this week's news round. Thanks to Dr. Lara Dungan and Dr. Shane Bergen from UCD. Coming up, what if you can pass on your trauma through your genes? Now, we know we inherit certain traits from our ancestors: hair colour, height, weight, eye colour, and even diseases. But what if the traumas of your parents, grandparents, and beyond are passed on as well? What can we learn from our past, and how might we be able to help our own kids in the years to come? Well, Dr. Brian Dias is a neuroscientist and assistant professor at USC Keck School of Medicine at the Children's Hospital in Los Angeles. He joins me now. Welcome to the program, Brian. What is intergenerational trauma?
Well, to begin, thanks for having me on, Jonathan. Intergenerational trauma is the concept that ancestral experiences affect descendant generations. And history is replete with a ton of events that provide evidence to us that experiences that parents or grandparents might have experienced actually leave profound imprints on offspring and grandoffspring. One of the most common examples that's discussed in this field is that of the Dutch Hunger Winter, where food was embargoed going into the Netherlands in World War II. And that nutritional impoverishment had influences not only on the generation that was exposed to that nutritional impoverishment while in utero when they were in their mother's bellies, but also the grandchildren who did not directly experience that nutritional impoverishment. And then there have been other nutritional insults like famines that have occurred across history. And we're also now appreciating that events like domestic abuse, events like the Holocaust, events like the terrorist attacks, the 9/11 terrorist attacks, leave imprints not only on the generation that's directly exposed, but also future generations.
So you're saying that I might suffer because of the experiences of my grandparents, and that is passed on through information in our genes?
Partly correct. And so what I'm saying is that, but we don't necessarily know how that information is passed along from your grandparents to you, how that ephemeral experience is passed along from your grandparents to you. There could be several routes by which this occurs. You could have stories that are recounted at dinner tables worldwide that get embedded under the skin, so to speak, and affect you and me. There could be parenting that you and I receive as a consequence of the ancestral experiences that our parents experienced that actually get embedded under our skin and then affect our lives, the disease states that we might manifest. You could also have babies who are in the mother's belly at the time of a particular event, and that maternal fetal communication is one way by which influences of maternal experiences could be transmitted to the fetus. And finally, most intriguingly, we're also gaining an appreciation for sperm and egg now bearing imprints of traumas, of events that occur, of experiences that occur. And as a result now, when the sperm meets that egg and the fusion results in an embryo developing, an embryo development is now affected as a consequence of those scars that sperm and egg might bear.
We have talked about epigenetics, this sort of layer of information on our genes that dials things up and down. And there is some evidence that epigenetic traits can happen quite quickly in between generations, and things like the Holocaust or famines can actually change the expression of those genes in children and grandchildren, right?
Yes. So the field of epigenetics provides us with a bridge that links ephemeral experiences of the detrimental or positive kind in one generation to the next. And what epigenetics essentially is it is reading your book of life and my book of life, our DNA, very differently, and putting down the equivalent of different punctuation marks that allow for that book of life to be read one way versus another. Hmm. And so one of the most attractive candidates that allows for information or experiences to be inherited across generations are these small RNAs, which we know more about in sperm than we know in egg. But I want you to think of these small RNAs as puppeteers, and they are puppeteering the expression of genes in our book of life. And so these RNA are then putting down the equivalent of full stops or commas at places where they might not actually have been, as a result of which your book of life and my book of life is being read one way versus it could have been read another if those RNA were not present in sperm.
How do we go about proving this in the lab?
We, of course, need to turn to more reductionistic models, and that could span organisms all the way from plants to rodents. And so plants, fruit flies, worms, mice, rats, across that entire spectrum, what we can do in controlled environments in the laboratory is we can expose one particular generation of any of those organisms to a particular experience. In plants, it could be a really cold temperature. In worms, it could be a particular pathogen, a particular food source that is made aversive to that particular worm. In mice, we could make a particular smell extremely salient to that mouse. And then we could look at how future generations are affected by that really cold temperature, by that taste aversion that is generated in an ancestral population of worm, or how the future generation of mice experience this odor, this smell that was made salient to a particular generation.
Can you talk to us about that mice study that you did, where you exposed male mice to acetophenone?
Right. So what we did was we took male mice and we made that particular smell, acetophenone, as you mentioned. Some call it cherry blossom. It smells like almond to me. We made that particular smell salient to that mouse, so that mouse remembers that smell in a particular way. And then we said, all right, now mice, you go ahead and mate. Give us your offspring, and now let's test whether those offspring, A, behave differently when they experience this cherry blossom, almondy odor, and what is the brains of these offspring look like? Do they devote more real estate towards processing this particular smell? And what we were able to show is that in the absence of any experience with this smell, acetophenone themselves, the offspring of mice whose fathers had been made fearful of this particular smell, these offspring now had more real estate, which they devoted to processing that smell, but they also were more sensitive to that particular smell.
Wow.
And we were able to show that the sperm of the father mice actually bore imprints of that particular experience with that odor.
Wow. So mice are sort of Pavlov's dog trained to not like this smell. And then children who'd never been exposed to this smell at all automatically know that this is not a good thing and devote more of their brain to it.
Partly true. Again, they do devote more of the real estate in their brain to processing this odor, but we actually think it has a positive advantage. It confers a positive benefit to the offspring, because what it tells the offspring, and we've shown this in subsequent papers, is that it tells the offspring, all right, now you're smelling this odor, something is off, pay attention to it.
Nice.
And so it's actually conferring an advantage to the offspring. And so this gets to that point about, is it always gloom and doom for the next generation whose parents or grandparents have experienced a traumatic event? And the answer is probably not. We don't know where that line is, but probably not.
Okay, so they didn't necessarily avoid the smell, they just knew to be wary of it or to investigate or be conscious of it more.
Absolutely. And so they were able to actually learn information about that smell much better than mice who didn't have that pre-existing sensitivity.
Now, were the offspring taken away from their parents? And I mean, is there any chance that the parents could have taught it in a, not via genetics, but via behavior? Or were the offspring taken away immediately after birth?
So that's a great question. And to be able to distinguish what we call social transmission, which is what you alluded to, from biological inheritance, which is information from sperm and egg, we actually performed several studies. But I think the one that proves that this was not social transmission and was biological inheritance was we performed in vitro fertilization. And we took the male mice who had been stressed with this particular smell. We took the sperm from those mice, and only the sperm. So there was no traditional mating that occurred. And all of these effects were recapitulated in that reductionistic framework. And wow. So that suggests to us that it's an inheritance. There's something in sperm that is being carried to the next generation that now affords the next generation the ability to process the smell differently and behave differently when they encounter it.
When you talk of things like the Holocaust, how does that manifest itself, the experiences of those who went through the Holocaust? Is it just the biological pressures that are put on someone who is starved? Or do we think that the stress of the experience is also passed down? Do we have a way of differentiating between psychological stress and the physical stress of being in the Holocaust?
I think this is such an important point, because we now know that not all stressors are the same. And it is really difficult to disentangle the psychological from the physical stressors in the event that you just talked about. And so the answer is, we don't know. We know, for example, now that there are things called adverse childhood experiences, which leave profound influences on the child that experiences that experience, but also future generations. And we know that not all adverse childhood experiences leave the same marks on the children. Mm. So neglect could leave one mark, but then household dysfunction could leave a completely other mark. Low socioeconomic status could leave a completely other mark. And so now we're faced with the conundrum of all these different stressors leaving different marks. How do you even begin to try and buffer the generation that's directly exposed, as well as future generations, from the myriad effects of these particular stressors?
Do we have an idea of whether or not you're more likely to receive or be affected by this intergenerational trauma if it's your father, the sperm that carries this message, as opposed to the egg?
There's much less literature discussing that phenomenon and investigating the relative quote-unquote importance of fathers versus mothers. By and large, we know that mothers can buffer a lot of the insults that parental experiences can bring to the fetus.
Right.
And so that is one possibility where you can start breaking legacies of trauma by intervening with maternal fetal interactions or maternal child interactions. And so that's an active area of research.
Do you think that COVID will have a similar effect on some people, on the next generation, if someone is going through COVID and passes this information on to the next generation, the experience or stress of going through this, or is this not necessary? Is this not just not in the same league as the other sort of stresses you're talking about, abuse, Holocaust, and so on?
COVID is firmly in the league of the stressors that we've been talking about, because it ticks off two boxes. One is it is unpredictable and it's uncontrollable. And we know that those are two factors that actually are hallmarks of stressors, where you don't have controllability and you can't predict when things are going to end and when things are going to get better. Now, the question is, who is affected and when are they affected? And so we also want to talk about critical periods, critical windows of development, wherein there are certain times of development where an individual is more at risk for bearing the imprints of a stressor versus not. And so we know that infancy and then adolescence are really critical windows of development where they seem to be. We know that children are sponges at these different stages, but not only for the knowledge and information that we give them in schools, but also everything that's happening around them.
Right.
And so here you have now COVID, which if an infant is experiencing the influence of COVID, and that might not only be the disease burden, but it might be the instability that comes from someone in the household losing a job, and then that infant unfortunately bearing the abuse that comes from the stress of that, or in adolescence, the inability to be able to go for your high school or college prep classes, and the instability that comes from not having those social relationships that one is forming in high school. All of those are going to have profound influences. Whether they go to the next generation or not is not something that I'm prepared to say, because yeah, time will tell. But we definitely know that the generation that's directly exposed is going to be affected, but it depends on what epoch of development they're currently in.
Based on your study and the sort of implications of it and this work in epigenetics, is it possible that we now have an idea of what the mechanism might be to explain how some children have innate fears, how, you know, dogs know not to, my dog doesn't jump off a high ledge. It's never jumped off a high ledge, but it knows not to do that. How we don't have to learn that from infancy because we have some knowledge of the world that's passed down somehow. Do you think this is how babies know these things?
I will say that I am not an expert in this field, but people have taken the work that we just talked about with the mice and have postulated that that is how instinct, which is what you're talking about, might actually develop. In biology, we talk about, and this comes with it with some caveats, but we talk about hardwired versus learned, and hardwired is the innate, the instinctual that you're talking about. And so some people have postulated and written about it, and there's active work in this area, that mechanisms like the one we just talked about with the mice might be one of the ways by which instinct got instantiated in a generation way back when, and then that gets fixed or assimilated in populations that allows for now instinctual behavior, like your dog not jumping off the ledge, to become quote unquote hardwired.
Right. And so the sort of epigenetic changes become sort of genetic changes over time, so to speak.
We want to be careful, because by definition, epigenetics does not alter the sequence of the DNA. Right?
Okay,
it doesn't alter the
all
book of life. It's how the book of life is read. And so, yes, if those punctuation marks persist over several generations, then you can say that the meaning of that book is going to be completely different 10 generations removed. Mm. But the book itself hasn't changed.
Right. Okay. And finally, do you think we can reverse this trauma in future generations, the children and grandchildren of tomorrow? Is it possible to fix that, do you think?
There is absolutely a malleability to this phenomenon, and that is the challenge for us as society to be able to reverse these and halt these legacies of trauma. And there's enough evidence to suggest that this occurs. Most of the evidence, of course, comes from population-based studies, fostering of children who were initially in orphanages, that reversed a lot of the impoverishment of care that was provided in those orphanages, for example. We also know that a lot of the challenge to reverse intergenerational influences of stress is going to be societal, and it's going to require public policy that allows for the buffering of generations to be able to reverse the imprint of trauma. So what might that look like? That might look like, and there's an active discussion, at least in the United States, about this, which is, does that require safe spaces to be built for children who might be at risk to bear intergenerational influences of stress, such that they could be buffered and they have mentoring that's provided to them, and they have supportive social networks, which they may not have in their immediate environments? And so those are the kinds of things which we know work, and there's absolutely the promise to be able to halt legacies. It's a question of how do we do it? Are we invested in it? And how driven are we to do it?
Really interesting speaking with you, Dr. Brian Diaz from the USC Keck School of Medicine at Children's Hospital, Los Angeles. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
I thought that was really interesting. I mean, I bought into the idea of epigenetics. It makes sense that if you go through a very hard series of winters and you're starving all the time, that that will make changes in your body. And, you know, if you're creating sperm or eggs, I understand how that might get passed along. But the idea of conversations, as Brian would say, had said, or that mouse experiment, I thought it was, a mouse experiment was weird. We bring in producer Aidan McKelvey to go through your comments from last week, but what did you make of that? The idea that you can train a mouse to not like a smell, and then its children will know innately that that smell is something to pay attention to. That to me is, that's something else. That kind of sort of opens the door to innate instinct, as Brian was saying.
Yeah, it's crazy. I thought, you know, when I kind of first saw that we were going to be talking about sort of memories being passed down, I just made the assumption it was like, you know, behaviors change and then that behavior influences the child's behavior, and it's like more straightforward.
Like in the case of abuse, where abused children are more likely to abuse, you mean?
Exactly, yeah. Because like, I actually have a friend whose grandfather was a survivor in Auschwitz, and her father then was obviously his son. And then she said that like all three generations, including herself, were quite difficult people with like, you know, hot tempers. And she sort of, you know, anecdotally said, oh, you know, maybe it inherited down from my grandfather, who obviously had lots of reasons to be angry. And that's sort of what I thought Brian would be talking about. But like, the mouse thing sort of blows my mind and also blows that theory a bit out of the water.
well, I mean, he was saying that it could be a mix of things. I'm not quite sure what the mechanism is. I'm sure there'll be critics of some of what Brian says. You can let us know, science@newstalk.com. But now to last week's comments. I want to let you in on a little secret. Philip Metzger, I know this is a radio program, that is a man suited for TV. I don't know if it's, I mean, he's a man and I'm straight, so it's totally okay to say, I kind of had a crush on him. Is that a weird thing to say? Let me just say, men and women, you know, whether you're straight, bi, gay, whatever, that was a fine looking guy. And he just had a magnetism to him. I was just looking into his eyes, and, you know, I'm happily married and very straight. Did you meet him face to face?
I did see a photo of him. He's a lovely looking man, a fine gentleman.
But he just had, you know, some people have this magnetism. When he was talking about moon dust, you know, which is, it is actually, I mean, I was going to say, which obviously is interesting. It's not obviously interesting, but it was fascinating. But it wasn't just that. He had a way, you know, like, you know, the old guy, the sort of sheriff fella in The Big Lebowski who narrates the story. He kind of reminded me of him.
Yeah, I can totally know it. Just by saying him, I know exactly what you're talking about.
He just had, I really hope he's not listening to this podcast because I said to him afterwards, I said, look, you know, love to have you on the program again.
Maybe come around to my house. We can do it there.
He's doing some really interesting research in rocket launches and a whole bunch and using resources on planets. Like his research is fascinating. So that's the only reason we'll be having him on the program, right?
Of course,
ladies and gentlemen.
I do think in fairness to you, his research is really interesting. All that stuff of there's actually a tie back there to the Apollo 11 landing. Just incidentally, I know he deals with like things landing on, say, planets in space and why they may or may not have like a crater under them. And I know there was no crater under the Apollo 11, the lunar lander. And they were very confused as to why. And I never found out why, but maybe
this
he might be
dude.
Able to tell us.
Yeah. This is the dude. Right, moving on before I get very uncomfortable. We were talking about the oblong shard-shaped object that passed through our skies that sort of confounded scientists with trying to figure out what is this object. And it turns out it seems to be some sort of shard of some sort of planet at some point. Alan says, I'll hold off on that book that claimed it was a manufactured object from an alien intelligence. So, well, look, this is it's a working theory. We don't know for sure. It could be either or, but the extraordinary claims, extraordinary evidence rule would probably apply here, I would imagine, Aidan.
Yeah, it's very disappointing. I did like that theory that's put forward by A.V. Loeb, I think it is, from Harvard. that it's an alien spaceship. I really want that to be real, but that doesn't mean it is more correct. In fact, it sounds like it's unlikely to be correct.
If only the world could be the way we want it to be. Yeah. Mark says, that Moondust interview was one of the best interviews I've heard in a while. How can something so small cause so many headaches? The dog fur idea is interesting. Yeah, fascinating to hear smart people come up with different ideas to get rid of dust. It's like, it's just weird to think that this is so much of a problem, but there you go. David McKeown says, great stuff. My group is looking at the effect of lunar dust on robotic mechanisms as part of an ESA contract. Dave McKeown is working on the AirSat satellite and is one of our renowned, I suppose, rocket engineers, space engineers. Garota Sullivan said, really enjoy that. Interesting to hear how difficult it is to replicate the dust's properties here. Yeah, like there's a whole industry of people who are manufacturing artificial space dust, and it's expensive. It's very expensive to make. If you didn't hear that interview, it's fascinating. You should listen back, and also listen back with the knowledge you now have from the first part of this podcast, and see what you think. Garota says, I was surprised you didn't mention the Arthur C. Clarke's novel A Fall of Moondust. It was written in 1961 and shows they were already thinking of issues with it. Now, that novel was speculative and got loads wrong, but it did identify how the fine dust could be a problem. If I remember right, before the first NASA probe landed on the moon, they weren't sure if it would sink or find firm ground. Amazing how quickly they got people there. Yes, that is true. They weren't sure what the composition of the ground was. Alan O'Duffy says, hello there. Just really appreciated your science program this morning. So fabulously resourced, informative and educational. Splendid work, big time. Well, thanks very much for that, Alan. And Alan says, I'm a friend of Jim Lockhart. Sort of embarrassing, I don't know who that is, but
is Jim Lockhart I might have this wrong, I haven't looked it up, but I thought he was one of the Apollo astronauts.
Is he not like from Horselips or something?
That would make more sense.
why would you yeah, he's from Horselips.
Who am I thinking of? The guy who was on Apollo 13 doesn't have a name like that.
Jim Lockhart in Apollo 13. I don't know.
Tom Hanks' character.
Anyway. I don't know. Well, let's leave it on that positive note then, shall we? It's always nice to hear that we're giving people something. We're not just wasting our time here, Aidan. thank you to producer Aidan McKelvey, the production team, Simon Keane, Stephen Daunt, Garrett Mulhall and Stephen Clune on sound. We'll be back with more Future Proof Extra in your podcast feed on Tuesday. Find it where you found this. In the meantime, stay curious.
What does innovation sound like? It sounds like the luxury of being in the moment with your customer, client, or patient. It sounds like having the right information right when you need it. It sounds like being at your best for your customers and your business. Thanks to Hyland's intelligent content solutions that improve digital processes, innovators everywhere are able to do their thing better, whatever that thing is. Now, who doesn't like the sound of that? Hyland, for innovators everywhere, visit hyland.com.